Hello and welcome to the History of Singapore, episode 45, The Man, The Myth, The Legend. Who is Lim Chin Siong? Over the last two episodes, we talked about Operation Cold Store. I ended with the observation that it has had a long-lasting effect on Singapore's democracy. It destroyed an entire generation of anti-colonial activists, people who could have made Singapore even better, with more prosperity, justice and equality than we have today. These men and women were held for no reason, some for decades. They were tortured and eventually broken by the horrific experiences they underwent in detention. Of all the targets of Cold Store, one stands head and shoulders above the others. Lim Chin Siong remains the great what-if, the great counterfactual of Singapore history. Sunny Liu's great graphic novel, The Art of Charlie Chan Hock Chai, explores this question brilliantly. The fact is that Chin Siong was feared by the British, by the Tunku, by Lee Kuan Yew. He was feared by the men who loom largest over our own history. Lee Kuan Yew was obsessed with defeating Lim Chin Siong. The Tunku openly worried that Lim Chin Siong's, quote, frightening organizational abilities and talismanic presence, unquote. And Lim was so feared that they ended up changing the constitutional arrangements of four different territories of the Federation, Singapore, North Borneo and Sabah, in order to defeat him. It's not an exaggeration to say that Malaysia was created for the primary purpose of defeating Lim Chin Siong. And that's amazing. Our lives were so deeply and massively changed. Our countries were rearranged all because of one man. Why was he so special? Why were they so fearful of him? Until recently, we didn't know much about him. It's as if he was erased from the pages of our history. The opening lines of Professor Tim Harper's seminal 2001 essay on Lim Chin Siong read, quote, "Lim Chin Siong is an elusive presence in Singapore's history." Harper calls Lim a, quote, "enigmatic figure with a mythic quality who lingers as a ghost," unquote. He's Banquo's ghost at the feast who haunts the feast but can't be seen himself. But fortunately, the vast amount of new material in the past decade, including the release of Lim's speeches in Chinese, the declassification of key documents by the British National Archives, as well as new material released by Lim's brother, Lim Chin Joo, allow us to see Lim Chin Siong on his own terms. It allows us to build a picture of the man and what he believed. It allows us to cast off this Cold War rhetorical baggage and the post-colonial rhetoric of state building that has to date defined Chin Siong. We've constantly had to look at Lim through the lens that Lee Kuan Yew held up for us, but no more. Let's see Lim Chin Siong in his own terms, in his own words, in his own right. From the very beginning, Lim was part of a broad wave of history, part of the broader nationalist anti-imperialist movement in Asia. The same wave that brought forth leaders such as Rizal and Agunaldo, Sun Yat-sen, Gandhi, Nehru and Sukarno. Indeed, like many people in his generation, Lim himself was conscious that he was part of a broad international historical moment. This theme of anti-colonialism as a broad international and inevitable historical force crops up repeatedly in his work. In 1992, he described the circumstances of his birth in this way, quote, "I was born in 1933. It was the fifth year of the Great Global Recession. The recession lasted relatively longer, and many countries were affected. Obviously, Singapore was affected too. So when I was about 3 years old, my parents moved from Telok Ayer Street, where I was born, to Pontian Kechil in Johor. I spent my childhood there. On July 7th, 1937, the Marco Polo Bridge incident occurred and the war between China and Japan broke out." Unquote. So, Lim's birth is defined by two forces, economic and political, the Great Depression and war. These formative experiences of Lim's childhood were part of the massive disruptions that I talked about in the early episodes of this series, such as the rise of nationalism and self-determination, the transformation of the Malayan economy and government, the crisis and failure of monopoly capitalism and the Great Depression, and the demographic changes resulting from a settled Chinese community. Lim was born in the midst of all of this, into a period of great intellectual debate in Singapore, marked by protest and riot. He was born during a period of oppression as the British colonial state clamped down. He experienced the Great Depression, the Japanese occupation, and the Malayan emergency as a Chinese man born to a working-class family and so subject to the worst economic depression, state oppression, and colonial discrimination. The oppressed peoples of Asia and Africa declared, in response to all of these events, that we should govern ourselves, and Lim was no different. Listen, quote, 1949 and 1950 were historic years. The anti-colonial movement in Asia and Africa swept the whole world. On October 1, 1949, the People's Republic of China was established. All the people in the school were very excited. They talked about, sang about, and embraced the coming of the new historical era. As Chinese students who were persecuted and despised the most, as slaves strangled in the shackles of the colony, the feeling and behavior were understandable. As a young man who was full of vigor, having experienced a lot of events which would not have normally been experienced by people at my age, I flowed with the tide of history, which was natural. Unquote. Following the Japanese occupation, the British reoccupied Malaya in 1945 and shortly after embarked on the oppression of the Malayan emergency in 1948. In stark contrast, the rest of the world was decolonizing. Indonesia declared its independence in 1945. India became independent in 1947. Burma in 1948. And the People's Republic of China declared its founding in 1949. These states, all of whom were intimately familiar to the people of Malaya, produced intoxicating feelings of excitement. Malaya's people could not help but contrast these states with their own plight, with their own oppression. This theme of the historic inevitability of decolonization runs through Lim's speeches. For example, in Lim's very first speech in the Legislative Assembly in 1955, he said, quote, Mr. Speaker, sir, today the colonial world is in a crisis because colonialism is unworkable in the modern world. I hope that the governor and the colonial officials will learn the lessons of history quickly for their own good and for the good of the people of this country by granting the people and their elected representatives real power. They are acting against history. They are acting like men who are foolish enough to suppose that they can prevent the sun from rising. And Lim sustains this theme throughout. He later continues, quote, This Merdeka movement is an organic part of the mighty current of the Asian Revolution. The greatest military powers of the Western world have had to retreat before this invincible current. Unquote. And later on he says, quote, Everywhere in the world, including this country, the people hunger for peace, freedom and democracy. But the policy of colonialism throughout the world, in British Guyana, the French policy in Indochina and North Africa, proves that freedom and democracy cannot exist under colonialism. Unquote. Lim is also keenly aware that he is following in the wake of some of the greatest men of history. If he can gaze so far to the horizon, it is because he is standing on the shoulders of giants. He has absorbed the writings and speeches of many of the nationalists who have come before him, including Sukarno and Nehru. And this is maybe the most fascinating aspect of Lim Chin Siong. Over the course of his abbreviated political career, just 6 or 7 active years in total, we can see the evolution of his thinking. At the beginning of his activist career, his rhetoric is very practically grounded, but derivative of the great Asian nationalists. By the end of it, he has developed and articulated a uniquely local and coherent platform of thought and action for the achievement of Malayan socialism. So, at the beginning, then, Lim is following the concepts espoused by the other great Asian nationalists, particularly Nehru and Sukarno. Indeed, Lim makes repeated references to them in his speeches over the years. And in particular, there are clear links with Sukarno's famous Islam, Nationalism and Marxism paper from 1926 in Lim's speeches. For example, when he says, quote, "It is, as President Sukarno has described, a part of the new emergent force, a force for a new order in society, a force that is being opposed by the old force which stands for domination, for the old order based on the exploitation of nation by nation, of man by man." Unquote. And the spirit of Bandung also has a massive influence on Lim. Following Bandung, we see a shift in his rhetoric as Lim began using the concepts associated with Bandung to connect local struggle with a broader international struggle for freedom and justice. The ideas emanating out of Bandung provided an ideological framework for Chin Siong and for the left-wing movement as a whole, to transcend ethnic and linguistic and class differences and share a platform for democratic expression and representation through the international language of anti-colonialism expressed as Singapore's democratic right to self-determination. Lim would develop this idea of the sovereignty of the people in response to local conditions to become the central plank of his vision for Malaya. Now, of course, Lim had already begun developing many of these concepts before Bandung. In campaigning for the 1955 elections, for example, Lim excited and inspired crowds with his speeches explicitly connecting violence and discrimination and worker exploitation as symptoms of colonialism. You'll remember this speech from episode 20, where he said, "Democracy in the colony is that if anybody does anything unwelcome, they will be called a communist. Under the emergency regulations, it is easy to deal with communists. Therefore, when the rich people want to dispose of the common people, they call them communists. They will then be arrested and lose their freedom. Without independence, the legs and hands of the people are tied. When you are tied up, you can only crawl along with your head. And when you want food, you open your mouth and the government will spit into it." Unquote. But he would quickly broaden this connection. The Bandung Conference, for example, had reaffirmed the UN Charter's principle of self-determination of peoples and nations and the right of nations to freely choose their own political and economic systems and their own way of life. Lim would echo this. He quoted the UN Charter in his first speech in the Legislative Assembly. And in particular, he stated that, quote, "The right of every community to develop its own language and culture must be respected," unquote. And that, quote, "The emergency regulations hold the trade union movement by the throat," unquote. And Lim reminded the assembly that, quote, "The real rulers are not present in this assembly. They are thousands of miles away in the colonial office in London. There has never been and never can be any substitute for full democracy and complete independence," unquote. Democratic policy, he emphasized, was policy formulated by a government responsible to its people. He continued to develop and expand the concept of self-determination in his speeches. In the debate over the Preservation of Public Security Ordinance in September 1955, he said, quote, "After 7 years of emergency regulations, the general social and political unrest in this country continues. This general unrest will continue and even grow until its basic cause has been removed. This basic cause is colonialism. If the general unrest, the political, social and economic dissatisfactions are to cease, colonialism must cease first. The emergency regulations have failed because they do not provide any solution for the political, social and economic problems of this country. These problems require political, social, and economic solutions, not punitive or military solutions. Colonialism and colonial officials cannot cure this disease because they are part of the disease themselves. The only solution for the disease of colonialism is the ending of colonialism and its replacement by complete political independence and full democracy for the peoples of this country." So, for example, Lim was aware of the unpopularity of the disruptions that widespread strikes caused, and that people struggled to understand the rationale for political strikes. So he repeatedly sought to explain to the public how the entire colonial legal and political structure heavily discriminated against workers. So in order to improve workers' rights, strikes could not merely address specific grievances. Political strikes were necessary to push for systemic reforms to create a fairer society. These strikes, he emphasized, would be non-violent and peaceful. The events of 1955, he argued, where targeted strikes pressured the government into enforcing its own laws, proved principled political strikes could achieve labour and democratic progress. Now, of course, many, in particular the commercial elite, the Chinese merchants, disagreed with Lim. So Lim would meet with leading Chinese businessmen to make these arguments. The businessmen agreed that the government was discriminatory, but political strikes hurt their businesses and workers, they argued, while having little effect on the government, which could easily arrest trade unionists and call in troops to restore order. But Lim replied that until Singapore's economy was in the hands of locally elected politicians, Singapore's economy would always be biased in favour of British capital. Economic and political self-determination were intertwined. The economic difficulties of merchants and employers were not due to workers' demands for fairer treatment, but due to colonial exploitation. The colonial government was responsible to London and naturally had to act for British interests. Thus, its policy was to buy raw materials from Malaya at low cost, ship them home for manufacture, and then send the finished product back for sale to the people of Malaya. It was in British interest to avoid developing local industry and manufacturing that would compete with their own. The lack of diversification of Malaya's economy made it vulnerable to swings in world demand, which was causing the mid-50s economic depression. If merchants and employers wanted to improve their businesses, then, well, colonial rule first had to be lifted. And political strikes cut away at one critical rationale for continued colonialism, which was economic profitability and capital accumulation. Or, as he would later say, quote, "If there is no real political freedom, there can be no long-term economic development," unquote. Or on another occasion, he said, quote, "In a colony ruled by another country, every issue of the people, whether political stability, economic development, or quality of life, is indivisible with the cause of anti-colonialism," unquote. Or, finally, quote, "Political rights, such as independence, liberty, democracy, and freedom, provide the country with the political conditions to improve people's lives and develop the country's economy," unquote. And if you remember all the way back at the beginning of this series, this is the same sentiment that Raffles expressed at the founding of Singapore, that economic liberty requires personal liberty. So this is 1956, and Chin Siong was still only 23 years old, but he was innovating and drawing together Singaporeans in an unprecedented way. Throughout 55-56, Lim Chin Siong argued that colonialism was a systemic issue that had to be addressed by anti-colonialists in a systemic manner. But he was no mere intellectual. He was a trade unionist, an activist, a leader, a field commander. In this period, Lim also successfully innovated with the structures of the mass movements, taking Singapore's fledgling associational democracy to a new level. Professor Harper memorably referred to this as his, quote, "personal alchemy," unquote. Lim drew upon the traditional Chinese mutual help associational model exemplified by the guilds and the Singapore Chinese Chamber of Commerce. And he also drew upon the pre-emergency Pan-Malayan Council of Joint Action model, which was an alliance between labour and capital. And he also drew upon the example of the Malay Education Council, probably the most successful association in this period when it came to lobbying for political change, and other successful anti-colonial models from around the world, and he synthesized them all into something that was uniquely Malayan. Organizationally, he stressed very heavily on the unity of the left-wing movement, and he sought to put principles into practice by creating associations via open community meetings of interested parties, which popularly elected leadership who sought to reach decisions by consensus and supported each other in their aims. These innovations in the form and structure of associational democracy, as well as his articulation of self-determination as the basic defining principle of anti-colonialism, find their apogee in the Anti-Yellow Culture campaign. This campaign shifted the aim of the anti-colonial movement towards attacking the moral authority of the colonial authorities to decide what was undesirable and subversive, and to decide the content of Malayan identity. So the colonial authorities would declare that activists were subversive. So instead of saying, "We are not subversive," as before, now Chin Siong's reply became, "Who are you foreigners, you imperialists, to tell us what is subversive? You are not citizens, you are not voters, you don't get to say what is subversive, we do." So this was self-determination extending to culture. And a wide range of Malay, Indian and Chinese organizations joined the Anti-Yellow Culture campaign. They attacked the colonial state's hypocrisy, for example, in allowing obscene or violent forms of Western culture, while simultaneously condemning all Chinese culture, even pre-communist, as subversive. The use of detention without trial was connected with the suppression of cultural heritage, while allowing unhealthy yellow culture to flourish. On 19th August 1956, over 800 representatives from a wide range of organizations gathered at the Singapore Badminton Hall and voted to form an anti-yellow cultural council. The 17-member executive committee was carefully apportioned to be representative of Singapore, four Malay, four Chinese and two Indian associations, four trade unions, two women's associations and one farmers association. The council was organized into three main linguistic departments, Chinese, Malay and English. They openly declared their aim was to raise political consciousness and, quote, to fight for a free, independent and democratic Malaya, unquote. This was Singapore's first anti-colonial association to transcend ethnic, class, occupation, gender, and political lines. It was a culmination of anti-colonial associationalism, the evolution of organizational methodology, the desire for left-wing unity, and the spirit of multiracialism and self-determination espoused by Bandung. This, here, is anti-colonial unity. It was a deadly threat to colonial political and moral authority, which is why it existed for barely a month before the government utilized the internal security laws to destroy the movement and clamp down on extra-parliamentary politics and activism in general. Internal documents clearly show that the government, including Lim Yew Hock, had been wanting to arrest Chin Siong and the rest of the left-wing leadership for a while. But as with Cold Store 7 years later, they could not find an excuse. So they manufactured one, under the guise of the infamous Pa Mata speech, to give them an excuse. We discussed this in episode 30. Chin Siong would be in prison for nearly 3 years, but he would use the time to read and learn and grow. Join us when we return to find out about the second phase of his political career. Following his release from detention without trial in 1959, Lim Chin Siong further developed his idea of self-determination into sovereignty as the core of his vision of Malayan socialism. In his vision, anti-colonialism was not just a goal, not just aiming for an eventual political transfer of power, not just political independence, but it was a process, a way of political life, where we evaluate the benefit of a policy first and foremost in whether it brings more sovereignty to the people, whether it empowers the people. This was his crucial innovation and, quite frankly, a brilliant one. It requires a sophisticated conceptual understanding of power and sovereignty. And perhaps most crucially, it requires a faith in the judgment of the people. Perhaps this is why this was not a vision that was embraced by Mr. Lee Kuan Yew, who has never really hidden his contempt for the majority of the population. So in practice, what does this mean? Well, let's take one example. One of Chin Siong's priorities was to end detention without trial by an unelected Internal Security Council. It's often misunderstood Lim was not against detention without trial per se. Rather, his position was that if detention were imposed by an elected government responsible to the people, then that government would then have to face the people's judgment, and that was acceptable. But under the 1954 Rendell Constitution, security was controlled by the British, not by elected officials. And from 1959, the Internal Security Council comprised a minority of elected Singaporeans. They had four members, three British and one Federation, who were not responsible, not elected by the people of Singapore, but who could outvote the three Singaporean members and order the arrest and detention of Singaporeans. As he said in October 1955, quote, "The laws of colonialism are meant to protect colonialism, not to protect the people. Only a free and democratic Malaya can pass a genuine public security bill which will guarantee the public freedom from detention without trial and the enjoyment of basic human rights," unquote. Or in June 1961, he said, quote, "What we want this time is real and complete internal self-government, which is worthy of its name. The government elected by the people must have all the power for its internal security. The current Internal Security Council must be abolished. The privilege of the British representative, which surpasses the Legislative Assembly and comprehensively intervenes in the affairs of the cabinet, must also be abolished. The government elected by the people must have complete power in culture and trade." So his principle is that the people must be sovereign first and foremost. And I think this is the aspect of Lim Chin Siong which is least known and least understood. Lim is often portrayed as some doctrinaire communist, which is a crude and oversimplified caricature. He may have believed in certain policies which we would call communist, but the most important thing to remember is, regardless of his personal beliefs about policy, he had a deeper, more strongly held commitment to self-determination, to accountability, to democracy, to the sovereignty of the people. In Lim's vision of Malaya, it is clear that his policies would be subject to democratic accountability. The people would get fair elections and a fair chance to vote out a government that wasn't up to scratch. And it is this reason why, from 1961, Lim attacks the PAP's proposed form of merger. Now, he wants merger. Everybody wants merger. But the PAP's proposed form of merger undermines Singapore's sovereignty. It undermines the sovereignty of Singapore's people. For one, the proposed form of merger makes Singapore underrepresented in the Dewan Rakyat, 15 seats instead of the 24-25 Singapore should have based on population size. For another, Singapore will be an exception to the rest of Malaysia. Different laws, different rights. We can only vote in Singapore. This was not merger. This was not building a new Malayan nation. Singapore would effectively become a quasi-colony of Kuala Lumpur. Or as Chin Siong said at the time, quote, "How can we make people of two different regions enjoy the same political rights and live the same political life? There can be only one answer. They have the same citizenship." So there can be only one principle. Different citizenship, no merger. Lim is actually willing to accept Singapore becoming an equal state on the same basis as all the other states, as long as all Singapore citizens become full and equal Malaysian citizens, even though it might potentially mean fewer rights for Singaporeans than before, because as long as we have equality, as long as we are all equally represented in the Dewan Rakyat, then we have a basis for struggling for a progressive Malaya, because we have a system in which the will of the people can be expressed, in which the people are sovereign, in which the government is held accountable. So you see, this is how he reconciles the internationalism of socialist rhetoric with local Malayan nationalism, by arguing that as long as lines of sovereignty are clear, that governments are directly and clearly accountable to the people, international socialism can connect with each other internationally. Indeed, he defines chauvinism as neglecting the anti-colonial struggle in other countries. He said, quote, "Socialists are not only nationalists, but also internationalists. It is our duty not only to fight against colonialism locally, but also to support wholeheartedly the struggle against colonialism that is being waged in other regions. If we are not internationalists, then we should rightly be called chauvinists. We recognize that colonialism and imperialism respect no national boundaries, and that there can be no coexistence between independence and justice on the one side and imperialism and colonialism on the other. We have rightly therefore fully supported the struggle against colonialism in Algeria, in the Congo, in Aden, in Cyprus, in Africa, and in Irian Barat." And this last is crucial because he specifically mentions Irian Barat, or West Papua. We know that at this point, his principles are more important than his personal loyalties, because by mentioning West Papua, he is calling out Sukarno. He is openly breaking with one of his heroes who invaded West Papua in 1961. West Papua remains a colony of Jakarta to this day. And more importantly, we can see the evolution of Lim's conception of sovereignty. Lim is speaking for a local, organic, anti-authoritarian tradition that grows out of the Malayan context and is underpinned by an understanding of freedom that asserts that as long as one is subject to a government that is able to exercise any form of arbitrary power outside the law, then one is living in an unfair state. And in this, he is echoing an old Republican argument in the English and American revolutionary traditions. If you, under any form of government that allows for the exercise of prerogative or discretionary powers outside the law, you will already be living as a slave. Your rulers may choose not to exercise these powers, or may exercise them only with the tenderest regards for your individual liberties, but as long as your rulers possess such arbitrary powers, it means that the continued enjoyment of civil liberty remains at all times dependent on their goodwill. And this is to say that you remain subject or liable to having your right to action curtailed or withdrawn at any time. And this is equivalent to living in a state of servitude. Unfortunately, this speech where Lim mentioned West Papua was the last major speech before his detention without trial in Operation Cold Storm, and the end of a promising political and intellectual career. So, in this short sketch of Lim Chin Siong, we can see why he was so feared. He was not just the moral and intellectual compass of the anti-colonial movement, but he was able to put his ideas into practice through innovation in organizational form and structure. He placed sovereignty at the core of his vision of an independent Malaya. He articulated a simple and powerful principle of sovereignty, which exposed how Malaysia was a betrayal of Singapore's people. But of course, the goal of British decolonization was not to transfer sovereignty, but to protect their interests after the transfer of power. And Lim saw through their machinations. Because of that, the British and their local allies Lee Kuan Yew and Tunku Abdul Rahman had to get rid of him. But I think Lim also continues to be, or perhaps is, coming back into relevance today. In a time where sovereignty has been undermined by the rescaling of global governance to multinational forums, when the neoliberal consensus has undermined sovereignty by heavily privileging the interests of global capital over the needs of local labour, when it is clear unrestrained neoliberal capitalism and globalization has also created massive exploitation and inequality, today we need a coherent platform on which to build a new progressive movement to balance out the powerful conservative elites who dominate Southeast Asia. Lim's platform of sovereignty as the center of Malayan socialism offers us, I think, a basic principle on which we can begin to rethink the current political and economic consensus. It speaks to concerns like race and ethnicity and culture, and offers a platform for progressive solidarity as an alternative arrangement for the region.
Lim's principle of sovereignty applies a simple test to any policy, any political platform, any vision for the nation. Does this increase or decrease the sovereignty of the people? Does it empower the people? Does it make them stronger? Does it make the government more accountable to the people? Or does it insulate political elites from direct accountability? Does it place more arbitrary executive power in the hands of political elites outside of the law? Does it reduce checks and balances? Does it decrease the sovereignty of the people? That's the first test of any policy, any law. Singapore's decolonization period is defined by Lim Chin Siong. From 1955 to 63, people were either trying to support him or trying to destroy him. He is without a doubt the greatest anti-colonial nationalist that Singapore has ever known. And one day when Singapore is free from the shackles that the official PAP version of history has placed on our minds, I'm confident that we will remember Lim Chin Siong as someone who fought and sacrificed and contributed so much for our freedom. And he and his colleagues in the Barisan Socialists will be remembered alongside the PAP's old guard as the founding heroes of independent Singapore. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. Thank you very much and see you next week.